Hello, I'm Sam, and this is Pilgrim Pit Stop. It's a podcast about following Jesus through life's highs and lows. And there's a new episode every other Friday. So I would really love it if you hit subscribe and tell your friends about it as well, if you enjoy what you hear. Here's a little clip of what's coming up today.
The nightmare scenario of imagining that Jesus was blue-eyed, fair-haired, and looked remarkably like he was born in Bognor Regis.
All right, let's go.
That could be it.
Okay.
We're in it. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you, Sam.
Nice. So, it is Sunday the 8th of November, 2020, and I'm here with my dad. Do you want to say where we are? Just sort of paint a picture for the listeners at home.
Okay, we're in a reasonably small bedroom in our house in Bristol, in England. And this is officially called my studio because it's where I paint, and it's crammed full. It's got a couple of easels. It's got lots of shelves with pots of paint and tubes of paint and mixing materials. It's got a table covered in work that's in progress, and under the table there's a load of canvases.
An impressive amount of canvases.
Yeah, so... And on the table is an open sketchbook that I think we're going to be talking about in a moment. And this is the first time in my life that I've actually had a room as a studio, because wherever we've lived before now, the studio has been the garage.
The garage.
And that's always been quite entertaining, because it means I've done most of my painting in artificial light.
In the dark. Because, yeah, one of the key things, isn't it, that you need natural light. That's kind of a key thing for an artist's studio.
Painting is meant to be much nicer when you can actually use natural light. And this room has a nice big window. So, yeah, it's a great little space to hide away a bit and do some work.
Yeah. How long have you been painting for?
Well, in a way, I think as long as I can remember, my father, your grandfather, never owned a camera, but always owned a sketchbook.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember pretty much, as long as I can remember. If we ever went away, he would sketch. And he had some fairly big jobs in the life of the United Reformed Church. And every Friday night was painting night. And he would do a watercolour painting on a Friday night. And then he would take it into the office on Monday morning with the objective of giving it away by the following Friday. And so I literally know of people all over the world who have ended up with a Bernard Thorogood painting, in part because they probably went for a meeting in his office and they happened to admire the painting on his board, and he took it down and gave it to them and they went away with it.
Yeah.
And I think for a long time I am an amateur painter, you know. It's not my primary source of income.
What's your primary source of income?
My primary source of income and my vocation is that I'm an ordained minister of the United Reformed Church. But I do also dare to call myself an artist, and I know you find it quite amusing when I tweet that's part of what I say.
You love Twitter.
And I do love Twitter. And I guess what happened was, after I was ordained in 1992, and I started realizing that I was using art a lot, especially in worship, especially in all-age worship, to try and convey messages from the Gospels visually, just because I think my bit of the Christian family, the Reformed tradition, can be very wordy, and I love words, and I love preaching, but I think there are times and ways in which words get in the way, or where you can't, you just can't express enough in words. And I started using art, and then I think the real the Rubicon moment was I did my master's in theology at Manchester College, at Northern College, at Manchester University, which is where the URC trains people. And a wonderful friend was my tutor, John Parry, who I'd known for a good many years. And John knew that in the background there was art floating around. And so he just, I remember, directly challenged me. He said, why don't you use this MA to explore if the art is a hobby or if the art is actually something fundamental to your ministry.
Mm.
And so in the end, my dissertation was an exploration of the Lord's Prayer, but it was an art installation in the college chapel. And I think gradually from then on, the art has grown and grown and grown to be a fundamental part of what I do. I've come here from having taught for 15 years in Cambridge, and there I was using art all the time. And at the college where I was teaching, we created an art studio and we had people come, and they found in art a way to express theology and their sense of who they were and their sense of who God is that was breathtaking, and often wouldn't have happened if we had just sat and talked or if they had had to write an essay. And I guess gradually that's led me to paint more and more. I paint mainly oil on canvas, and I have stuff on the web. And the great thing about being at Westminster College in Cambridge was that we had big wall space, so I hung lots of art
all around
whilst I was there, and started to sell, and very remarkably people wanted to buy, so I sold stuff.
Not remarkable at all.
And I make it into cards if people want that. I can reproduce it as digital prints if people want that.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, the art can live on and travel and go to places and be available to people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's have a look at, so I've got your website here. So this is Neil Thurigood Art. And one sort of thing, how long have you been doing these Bible from the Air pieces for?
I guess maybe since about 2004, something like that. I think the earliest ones. So you've just gone, yeah, so that one there, the Journey of the Magi, I think that's one of the very first. And it's, I think, can you zoom in? It should have the date somewhere.
To the bottom right.
2004, I think. Or it may say, if you, it may just say the information.
I've messed it up.
You've messed it up.
I've messed it up.
Too high tech for you. If you scroll down to the information.
Oh, okay.
It'll say.
Yeah, 2004.
There
it is.
And I've always been fascinated by the books you can buy that show the world as if you're looking down on it. And I mean, they used to be, you know, they were only possible from a helicopter or a plane.
Mm.
And now, either you can get the most amazing things with, you know, the astronauts in the International Space Station have taken photos, or someone sends a drone up or whatever. But I've always thought that that's just a really interesting perspective that we never see with our feet firmly on the ground. So that led me to start to think, well, what would it be like if you could paint pictures of the Bible as if a drone was flying over as that story unfolded, you know. So there's a series on my website called The Bible from the Air, and it's just a growing series.
They're amazing. I mean, there's so many.
I know.
They're amazing. Going. And then quite a few of them you've done maybe
twice
or three
times. So the repeats are where people commission me. So rather, instead of wanting a digital print, they want a new original watercolor, oil painting. And so I painted again. So I think the one, The Calming of the Storm, I think I'm now on version 7 or 8.
and they are all different?
They're all different. So, I mean, I can reasonably accurately do an exact, you know, reasonably exact copy. But actually, yeah, the reality is each of them has a life of its own. For me, the joy of painting is that happy accidents happen, and you get serendipity. And suddenly you get one brushstroke next to another that you didn't plan.
Yeah.
And it just looks right.
And you were saying when you did the most recent Calming of the Storm, you realised that there were multiple bones in one of the gospel accounts.
So here you go. Here's a minister who needs to read the Bible more carefully. I think one of the other things about art, especially art about the Bible, is that through stained glass windows or through the great paintings that are in art galleries, we kind of build up a digital memory, you know, visual memory of the Bible. So, you know, the classic example of this is, you know, the nightmare scenario of imagining that Jesus was blue-eyed, fair-haired, and looked remarkably like he was born in Bognor Regis rather than living in first century Palestine. Or that God, you know, God is an old white man with a beard floating on a cloud. That's one of the risks. And one of the interesting things is I think I had somehow imbibed so many images of Jesus calming the storm that are basically almost invariably a close-up of him in the boat calming the storm. But when you read the story, it explicitly says, and other boats were with them. So it's a flotilla.
Yeah, which completely changes the imagery, doesn't it?
And, you know, when I redid one of the paintings where it's lots of boats, it does. It changes what the image is. But I think it also changes your understanding of what's going on. He's not just calming the storm for him and his disciples. It's not just a story about if you're really close to Jesus, he will save you. Because actually, we don't know anything about the faith commitments or understandings of any of the other people in the boat, in the other boats. But they are also saved.
Yeah.
You know, the storm is calmed, unless you imagine that the storm is literally just calmed around the boat that Jesus is in, which I don't think is what the story is about. The storm disappears. And so it's actually a story about how salvation spreads and isn't focused on one little group of people. And so that was a nice example of where actually rereading the text, because I was going to paint it again, literally notice. I think for the first time in my life, it made me notice a few words in the text that I had somehow just never quite noticed before. And I guess that's why I like doing these paintings, because I suppose what I'm hoping, especially if it's a painting of a really familiar scene like the Nativity or the Crucifixion, that maybe changing the perspective so that we're looking down on it, kind of a God's eye view, although I don't like that language, because God's eye view is also in the dust looking upwards. But you know, that looking down maybe just fires our imaginations a bit, because it just makes it slightly strange.
Yeah, one of my favourite ones is slightly strange is the Tower of Babel you did, which when you first look at it, you're not quite sure what's going on, and then you realise there's kind of a square, which is the top of the tower, and then just a really long shadow sort of stretching away out of the frame, which is a genius way of showing how high the tower is without actually showing it.
I know. One of the brutally significant reasons why I do a lot of these is I'm not very good at painting people. And it's much easier to paint a few dots and then draw the shadow of a person. So that's another part of it. I think maybe one of the drawbacks of the series is that inevitably you're looking at it from a bit of a distance. And I have had conversations with people who've said, yeah, but it's, you know, how does it draw me in? And I think that's an interesting one. And sometimes other paintings that are, you know, where you have a real sense of close-up. And someone like Rembrandt was brilliant at this, you know, where you're seeing the expressions on the faces. That's what communicates. I guess what I'm inviting us to do is to imagine, okay, so I'm looking down on this, and in my imagination, what would it be like to now go down and be there in the action?
Yeah. Well, I think the reason we're here recording this now is that you're currently planning a new Bible from the Air piece, aren't you? And I thought it would be cool to kind of capture that process a bit for this podcast. So record this conversation right at the start of the journey for you as you're starting to think about what colours are going to go into it, and then record another episode, you know, in a few weeks' time or months' time or however long it takes.
Indeed.
Kind of looking back and reflecting, and you can talk about the finished products and people can then go and check it out. So we're here with your sketchbook and I think, you're going to walk me through your process. So how does it start?
Okay, so the process starts, I think, with the text. Like you know, I love preaching because I think in preaching we start with the Bible. And it's so that's the starting point. So the text that we're in for this next painting, I've painted it once before, but it was on two little tiny canvases, is the very familiar story. It's Luke's Gospel, chapter 15, beginning at verse 11, which is the parable of the lost son, or really, perhaps a better title for it is the two lost sons, because the elder son is as lost as the younger one in a different way, I think. So the starting point is having the text in front of me, as I do. And I guess another starting point is knowing what I want to do scale-wise. So if I can just play around with an easel.
So that's now just adjusting an easel.
So we're just going to open this up. This hasn't really been opened since we moved into this house, so that's a good moment.
Oh, so this is a way that you can physically see how big the canvas is going to be. And
so here's the canvas.
Oh, nice. So tall and thin.
So it's tall and thin. Might as well put it the right way up. So it says it's 100 centimetres by 50 centimetres. So I'll just lower that down now. And when we get to the actual painting part, I'll take off the wrapper around it.
Yeah.
And we'll do a bit of hammering on the back to tighten it. And what I've been thinking about is I've actually got two of these canvases. So there's another one down there. And I think I'm kind of I'm kind of enjoying the idea already in my mind that it's a story that falls into two parts, and it almost falls into two parts of the world. So one part of the story is located around the family home, and the other part of the story is located in a country far away. Where the younger son goes off and has his debauched life and then ends up penniless and in a famine. As Jesus tells the story in verse 13, he says, not long after that, after the younger son has asked for his inheritance, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. And I think it might be kind of fun to actually paint this on two identically sized canvases that would then hang on the wall side by side.
Oh, okay.
And one of them is going to be the stuff that revolves around the family home, and the other one is going to be the stuff that revolves around the distant country. And I suppose in my mind, I'm imagining that what I might have a go at doing, which will be a departure, is rather than just homing on a single moment of the story, to try and do the entire story from beginning to end.
Okay.
And so that makes me move to my sketchbook, where I have a nice blank sheet of paper. And where are we? I always put the date on a sketchbook page, just so that I know. And we'll call this the Parable of the Sons. And on this nice blank sheet of paper, and the great thing about a sketchbook, I find, is that you can do stuff in a hurry, in rough.
So you've just drawn two
big rectangles side by side. So they're going to be my two canvases. And I guess what I'm kind of thinking about, there's a lovely sense of the flow of the story, you know, that it follows kind of a circle. So for sake of argument, I'm just now drawing a circle over the whole thing. So half of the circle is going to be on one canvas and half is going to be on the other, and maybe almost a pathway so that your eye follows the circle round. So somewhere, and this is where this may evolve, but if I if I call, I mean, the way we tend to read a painting is we tend, in the West, we tend, our eyes tend to go to the top left because that's where we tend to look on a page. And so, for sake of argument, I'm going to call the left-hand rectangle, the left-hand canvas, home. And I'm going to call the right-hand one distant country. And I guess what I'm imagining is that somewhere, so if we imagine it like, maybe the easiest way to describe it is like a clock face with the hours, you know. So I'm kind of thinking now that maybe at round about 11 o'clock, there's going to be a scene. And the scene is probably going to involve looking down on a house and maybe some trees. Because it kind of feels like they're a reasonably prosperous family, because why else would the father have some property to divide? And I could imagine maybe there's a scene outside with the father and the son.
So for this, you're just drawing
kind
of very simple representations of the house, the trees, the father, the son.
Yeah, and I'm always interested in which way the shadows go, and I think the shadows are going to be... we're going to imagine that the sun is shining in from the left, so the shadows will go.
And is there a reason for that, or is that just kind of aesthetic? You think that's going to work nicely with the composition?
What I want is if that's the thing that's going to kind of catch your eye first, I want it to draw your eye further into the picture. Mm-hmm, so I think if the shadows point into the next, you know, if they point from left to right, it'll maybe help to carry the eye.
Yeah.
So I'm imagining that there's a sort of, it's a difficult start to the story. Somehow, I think maybe by just having the two figures, everyone else is away or in the house or whatever. So there's a sense of just two people and a bit of a confrontation, and this is the asking for the money. And then I think maybe at about 12 o'clock, just heading away from the canvas would be the son walking off on his own.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, the power of the story is it's a story about how we get lost and how we leave God behind and we think we can do everything on our own. So there, that would be, I think, we then have this younger son, and I guess I'm now thinking maybe about 2 o'clock, and we're now on the right-hand canvas, which we're calling distant country, and I think we need something that shows this son having a whale of a time. Mm-hmm. So I've been thinking, how do you show kind of having a debauched time from the air? And one thing I wondered about was, could we imagine almost a great outdoor party? So maybe it's about, you know, some trees, which are just going to be, I'm thinking maybe we're in a big posh garden or something. And then maybe there are lots of people. This is going to be quite a tricky bit to do.
So are we zoomed out now? They have smaller figures.
Yeah, maybe they are. Maybe we've zoomed out a bit. Maybe there's a fire burning somewhere. So that'd be nice and orange. Maybe this is almost... maybe this bit of the canvas will be darker,
mm-hmm.
so it'll be more sort of dusky, and so there would be candles burning, maybe tables with food. Maybe somehow I would need to try and represent people dancing. So, but lots of people, because I think part of the sense of the story is, to begin with, he's having a whale of a time and it's going well, and everyone loves him because he's got lots of money and he's a party animal, and so he's someone that people want to be around. And then everything goes horribly wrong, and I think we probably then the next scene...
So you're looking on...
So I'm back to the Bible.
Now, aren't you?
Yeah, so I'm back to the Bible. So after he had spent everything, there was severe famine, and he goes and hires himself out, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs.
So I think we then would probably zoom in and we'd probably have him just sitting in a field. I have no idea what pigs from the air will look like, but, you know, we'll guess.
So will you just look that up online when it comes to it to kind of get the reference?
Yeah. So what I'll do, I mean, I've got books that, you know, I've got some lovely books that look at things from the air. So what do trees and houses and people... I've got some lovely books that show, you know, how people's shadows change as they're walking or standing still. And somewhere or other, there will be photos and images of a pig farm from the air. Yeah. And I'll probably, you know, I'll need to also get it right in the sense of what would pigs have looked like then? I mean, I don't know. We're so used to seeing pigs that are very pink. But, I mean, it may be that pigs in the far-off country, which is presumably somewhere in the Middle East, you know, maybe they'll look different. And, of course, part of the power of the story is this is a Jewish man who is now looking after pigs, which Jews are not meant to be. So,
I hadn't caught that.
So it's unclean. Everything is wrong. Jesus, as he so often does in the parables, is ramping up the horror and the tension. So then there is this lovely moment, as Luke put it, when he came to his senses. He then thinks, okay, I'm going to have this speech. I'm going to go home. I'm going to say to my father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. So he got up and went to his father. So I think, if when he's with the pigs, if we imagine that's kind of 3 o'clock, then maybe about 5 o'clock, as a nice echo to where we started, he's now heading home. And as I'm doing this, I'm just thinking, it might be kind of fun to deliberately always imagine that the sun is, as it were, at the back of the sun, S-U-N, is always behind the younger son,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that his shadow is always thrown in front of him.
Right.
So that we get a sense of movement. So the distant country, I think, that half of the painting will be, at the top it'll be the big party. Somewhere in the middle, it'll be him on his own with the pigs in the field. And then right at the bottom, heading off towards the left, it'll be him coming to his senses and going back to his father. Then we move back to the home one.
And so we're on the left-hand side canvas again now.
So we're on the left-hand side canvas, and I think we've got the son still on his way. This is where we're going to have to play things a bit carefully. So the son is still on his way, and I think we've got the father running to meet him with his arms outstretched. Mm-hmm. And so at the bottom there's this massive reunion happening.
How does it describe it in the text?
We get to Luke 15 and verse 20. So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. So there's this amazing, and it is an amazing, you know, this is the father who has every reason to want nothing more to do with this son, who has humiliated him by asking for the inheritance. He has effectively said, I wish you were dead. He's left him behind. He squandered the inheritance. And now he's coming back. And the father, you know, would have every reason to reject him, to be furious, to call on all sorts of justice.
Mm.
And instead, we have this extraordinary picture of literally the father running to meet him, which is suggestive of the fact that the father has been waiting for him to come back. And, you know, even as you say it, you can feel the power of that image in the story Jesus is telling. You know, this is what God is like. God is like the father who knows we've got lost and who runs to meet us.
Mm.
You know, if we take one step towards God, God takes 100 towards us. And that's what's happening. So that's going to be down there. And then there is this really lovely... So the father says, you know, bring the best robe, put it on him, put a ring on his fingers, bring the fatted calf, and then they have a party. So it's so kind of as a nice echo of the debauched party in the distant country. I imagine we might have another party. So maybe we've got the house and some trees, but you know, I think we would have quite a few people and a sense of a happy gathering, and there'd be a fire burning and some smoke. It's always kind of fun to do fires and smoke, because you can kind of do the smoke drifting.
You've done the burning bush, haven't you?
Yeah, you can have the smoke drifting across a bit. We might have some smoke over there.
Mm. This is looking great.
And then there's the really significant bit of the story that we often, you know, which is why I always think it's better to think of it as a story of two lost sons. And I think this is the challenging bit of the story for the church. And I think that's... It's good for us to hear it, because there's this elder brother. And the elder brother can't believe what's going on. And the elder brother is jealous and angry and frustrated and says, but look, I've been here all these years and you've never done any of this for me. And then this son of yours, and it's very interesting, that language, this son of yours. So it's not, he's not my brother. So as far as the elder brother is concerned, their relationship has ended. And the father should have nothing to do with him. Which is, you know, that's kind of what you would expect. And the wonder of the story is that the father then has to go out from the party to this other son and has to bring him in as well. And I've often thought of this story as speaking to the fact that, you know, churches are tremendously keen on welcoming people in. But the temptation is we welcome people in and we want them to be like us, and we want them to come in and become like us, and sometimes they're not, and occasionally maybe those of us like me and others maybe who've been in the church all our lives kind of watch new people coming in, and we get a bit uppity and a bit jealous and a bit annoyed. And we say, you know, well, you know, why should we change our style of worship for these folk who've only been coming for a few months, when we've been here for 50 years? Why can't they settle into our style of worship, or whatever it might be? And it's a story in which Jesus says, but you know, whether you've been here 5 minutes or 50 years, you are equally loved, and you are equally welcome. And I think that's a glorious thing, but it's not always an easy thing to live, because there's a deep thing in us, I think, that kind of wants to make faith into some kind of equation. If I put X in, God will give me Y. And the joy of the gospel is that God says, I'm not interested in your equations. You know, I don't do equations. I just love you.
Yeah.
So I think there would be sort of the final thing, maybe about 9 o'clock on our imaginary clock face, there would be another reconciliation. Although it's interesting, Jesus ends the story not telling us if the older brother joins the party. So like a really good storyteller, Jesus leaves us hanging in the end. You know, does the older brother go in? Are the two brothers ever reconciled? Does the older brother storm off? We don't know. So I think the final scene might be the father, another, in a sense, it's almost another confrontation between the father and the older brother. So at the moment it looks a bit of a mess, and it does look awfully complicated, and even as you know, and I'm
so the challenge I guess is going to be how do you guide the viewer's eye, because there's quite a lot going on, isn't there?
And I think one way to do that might be, and this is where we might want a bit of, and I'm going to play around with a bit of colour. So it's all very exciting having set up this new studio, but the snag is I can't remember where anything is. So I'm just
what are you looking for? A coloured pencil or something?
I'm looking for some pastels. Here we go. So sometimes it's nice to just do something with some. So here are my old pastels. And I'll just eat a crisp.
So is this just then to kind of give you a sense of what it might look like in terms of colour, but not to fill everything in, just to suggest, okay, this bit's going to be green, this bit's going to be orange.
So I think one way to do this would almost be to give it a sense of a pathway. So I'm just doing a big sort of lightish yellowish circle that becomes the pathway in the middle of the painting. And then I often do, you know, things quite sort of orangey and so on to represent the rocks and things. So I think you could maybe do a bit of that.
Well, it's amazing how just adding colour just brings it to life, doesn't it, straight away.
And there'd be some greens for where there are trees growing. And maybe a little bit of something slightly darker. Yes, I love playing with texture of colour. You've got to be a bit careful because at the end of the day, the shadows are going to be dark. So there's no point in having a dark background because we'll lose the shadows. But I think already that, I'm imagining the house would be very light, very, very white probably. Trees green, people in whitish colour probably, shadows dark. Sort of greys and navy blues and blacks. And then I'm imagining that maybe it might be kind of fun to do a real contrast. So over on the other country, I'm doing quite a lot of green. In fact, maybe the top, that might be kind of fun. So the top is green. Where he's having his debauch time, it looks really fertile. And then it suddenly becomes desert. So that we get the sense that we move into something much more barren. So I think, you know, we can do something like that I mean, I tend to paint, when we get to the painting stage, I tend to paint very much on the canvas. I mix colour on the canvas. I don't tend to mix on the palette. And I love oil because you can move it around and blend it. So, even as I'm looking at this, I'm not so keen on just a simple circle. So I think that doesn't quite work. I think we might want something that's a bit more sinuous. So it becomes more of a, so there is a visual path around these scenes. So it's almost like these are scenes in a passion play where you would walk with the players from scene to scene, and it would be a promenade performance.
Kind of performance. Yeah,
I'm imagining that. I guess that the painting is a promenade. And you can follow the different bits, and you know, it's not going to be hugely obvious. I think if people know the story well, there may be elements of the... I'm hoping that there's enough here that would become obvious so that people can then pick out the rest.
I think, yeah, your eye naturally goes to the top left, doesn't it? So as long as you're starting there,
yeah.
I think then you're guided round quite nicely.
I think so. And I think, you know, the idea of having it on two separate canvases hopefully reinforces the sense that the action is happening in two different parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that's a starting point. I mean, I think I'm not totally sure yet. I think the thing I'm least sure about is imagining which direction the sun is shining. Because it does become confusing if on one canvas the sun is shining from left to right for one scene and right to left for another. So I think that, yeah, I think I might almost have to draw it again and just see, does it look better if there's a consistency in the shadows, or does it not matter? Because the beauty of this is, of course, you know, we could be looking at it from any angle. It doesn't necessarily have to work, but it does have to work visually. If it is just confusing and a bit of a mess, then I think people won't enjoy it and it won't speak. And the other beauty of oil is that you can, if something really isn't working on the canvas, you can remove it. You can wipe it off with a rag, or you can let it dry and paint over it. And I've done that a fair bit. But I think there is the beginnings of something there, and I think that could work.
Awesome.
So there we go.
There we go. Well, thank you very much, Dad.
You're welcome. It's
been great to see your process, and we'll pick this story up whenever you think you've finished it, and we can talk about the finished product.
Okay.
Nice. Well,
thank you for listening.
Have it. My conversation with the Dad Man a few weeks ago. Really enjoyed seeing into his kind of creative process. Obviously, I've grown up seeing these amazing paintings that he produces, but actually, I've never really been in on the process like that. So that was a treat for me as well. Hope you enjoyed it. And yeah, you know, when he has completed this particular painting, I'll do another conversation with him where we can maybe talk some more about, you know, Dad's story and also the finished piece and kind of the choices that he made along the way. Do check out Dad's website where you can see his art, and you can buy prints and cards and whatnot. I'll put a link in the old description. Yes, I think that's everything. Oh, there's also a link in the description where you can buy me a coffee if you want to support the podcast. That's just a fun way of doing that. So many thanks as always to Johnny Davies for creating the wonderful theme music, and to my brother Thomas for the jingles. Yes, wonderful. Hey, look, just really appreciate you listening to this podcast. You're great. Have an amazing 2 weeks, and I will speak to you soon. God bless.